Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had
Low and OPEX, Dax and Jax. I'm Tamale Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 31. NASDAQ Futures up 40. We got the whole new dynamic here on the stock market. We got a whole new pricing mechanism. And the price is to the moon, Alice. To the moon. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
So what's good about this morning?
What's good about this morning? Well, yeah. The Cubs just beat the Dodgers for the second night in a row. That's pretty good.
Plus they beat their fancy new pitcher, too.
And they didn't exactly beat him, but they did. He did leave down 2-1, but it wasn't like he pitched poorly, or that they beat him up. They did play the Dodgers with Scooble pitching and beat them anyway. So you know, and what's really weird is that it was. Especially last night, it was such a good, such a well-played baseball game. Let me put it that way. There really isn't too much to complain about. That, you know, there's times watching the Cubs when they don't execute with a man on third and less than two outs. They fail to put the bat on the ball. They can be frustrating at times. But last night, they played just a really good, fundamentally sound game. Their defense is so good. And Javier Assad, I don't know what his role is going to be after the trade deadline pickups that the Cubs had, but my goodness, that guy has been a godsend while they've suffered all their through so many injuries to starting pitchers, and that guy comes out and he gives them a pretty good chance to win every time he pitches.
Yeah, I agree. When I said what's good about today, when you walk out and you hit the garage door opener and the garage door doesn't go up, you know you got a problem.
Well, that could be a small problem. Was your power out in the garage?
Or no. It's
broken.
It's the door, and the even weirder part is that the since the truck is so friggin' big, you can't get around it to get to the side of the door that's busted. So I gotta call my guy. So fortunately, Andrew was coming this way in the cab, and he came and got me. So here we are. So.
Oh, you can't open the door. It's not the opener; it's the door.
Well, no, the opener can't open the door. So there's something. Something must have slipped, one of the bearings or something.
Well, but then the opener should have a little, it's like almost like a pull chain of some sort that you can release the opener and just lift up the garage door yourself.
Yeah, except for the fact that the door is bound on the one side. The rollers must have slipped or something.
Roller slipped or spring broke.
Yeah, well, the spring is new, so it can't be that well. But I guess it could be.
Yes, it can.
But we'll find out. But the curious part is how's the guy going to fix it with the door and the pickup truck an inch away from the door?
So, did you tell him to send the skinniest people they have?
The guy usually comes out. I know the guy. He's pretty skinny.
Okay.
I don't think anybody's that skinny. Anyway. I'm sure they'll find a way, but
all over your truck, Tom.
Yeah, it's whatever. I'm sure they'll figure it out. What interesting day in the market yesterday, Kevin? With the I'm really kind of stunned at the depth of the rally for 3-4 days, and I think it really does all go back to really the announcement by the administration is they're going to pour money into the system. And you keep thinking. And obviously Carl's all over it, and so is Hal, that they're doing way too much here. I mean, all they're doing is pouring inflation into the place. But I don't think anybody cares, Kevin, and it's not just this group. I don't think anybody for the last 25 years whenever there's a problem, you pour more money in, and we'll see how bad it gets. And it never seems to get so bad unless you talk about the inflation pressures on some people. But, I mean, the $10 billion they popped in, I never dreamed they were going to – I knew they were going to add money somewhere. But I tell you what, they shocked me by doing it that way. So they poured that in. They scared the bejesus out of some people in the Japanese market. And isn't it amazing how – I mean, this is the big firms of the world – That guy that had the $20 billion that everybody said, you know, he had all the margin and stuff, he made all that money. They took that bastard out at the absolute low, Kevin. This is about the fourth time I've seen that in my career. That is freaking criminal. That is criminal. The market's up so much from where they made that guy sell everything. It's scary what this stuff is. But just to give you a figure, I mean, everybody knows I never give market advice, but I will, you know, lob some statistics out there and say again that in 2000, when the crash happened, now the crash, that was different because the Fed started to pull some money back in after the Y2K didn't happen, the Y2K fiasco. So when the stocks were amazingly overvalued, the Fed kind of pulled back a little bit, which I think was, you know, caused the market to turn around. Well, we're not going to do that this time. We're just going to keep pouring in until we become Weimar. I mean, we don't seem to care. And anybody who says they aren't. But the weird part, Kevin, is Palantir yesterday. And, you know, Kenny was on talking about they blew out earnings, which they did, by the way. But their earnings, he says they're up like 50%. Well, they are. They're up from $2 a share. This year they're going to be $3.50 a share. If they make their wild estimates. Okay. In 2000, when the stocks like Cisco and Oracle and those guys got to be 11, 12 times revenue, not earnings, revenue, that's when the crash all happened, the dot-bomb blow-up. This time, these guys are now 46 times revenue. Their move up yesterday of $35, If you look at the, revenue is going to be $3.50 a share this year. The move yesterday is 10 times revenue for the year. And the weird part about it is there doesn't seem to be any. I mean, there's no seller any place. I mean, why would you? But this is anecdotal kind of stuff. But whenever you'd see a stock kind of run up before earnings and a stock looked like it was pretty highly priced, right? The information in the market would be pretty accurate. And all of a sudden, the firm would come out with like really good earnings, maybe surprise people on the revenue side. And then the stock would like sort of stop there. Hence this, the old adage, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news. And the stock would like stop there. But here, people obviously felt that this firm was going to do that, okay, and they're going to come out with, you know, they're trading 130, which was pretty friggin' high, maybe 120, it's pretty friggin' high, and that they were going to come out with some really good numbers, and they did, which to me, maybe you could say sort of justified the $120 price. Why it would go up 20% from there, I have no idea, but it did. But it's happening to the entire market. I mean, Caterpillar was up 15, 20%. We're not talking about 1, 2% moves anymore. 5, 10, 20% moves on some of this stuff. And it all has to do, I think, with money. It's not with, I mean, when is Palantir going to make, you know, for $160 bucks, when are they going to make $8 a share and send you a check for $250? Never. And yet that's what it's priced at. I mean, people just price things differently now. And I think a lot of it has to do with the degrading of the dollar. I mean, it's not the stocks going up, the value of the dollar is going down. And I don't know, you know, what, if you know, I guess if I'm the person who's in office, you know, we can talk all we want about, you know, not wanting to put money up for the Bears, right? But we also, if we were the mayor, probably wouldn't want to be the mayor that lost the Bears. So it's like, you know, politics is a business. Maybe we just don't understand the business. I mean, there's no way on earth this administration or any other wants the market going down between now and November. And if they have to worry about inflation a year from now, screw it. We'll worry about it a year from now. And yet, the problem is the rest of us, we're kind of the people caught in this chain. I mean, when Bush won, thought that the reason why he didn't get elected was because the Federal Reserve didn't pour money in his last year, and that's why he lost to Clinton. I mean, I think he probably to this day hates Greenspan.
Actually, they were buddies.
Well, but I mean, he was pissed at the Fed.
They were long term buddies, yeah.
But I mean, it's you know what?
Because basically, they were the same, you know, world economics point of view.
Right, but they. What I'm saying is that he would have appreciated a little goose the last year, and he didn't get it. And you know, I don't think there's any question that you know, this group or the Biden group or whoever the current people are. I mean, if you ask them, you know, will you trade a healthy stock market between now and November for a bunch of inflation next year? I mean, you're not getting anybody to say no, are you? Besides, they're the ones that are in the market, for God's sake. I mean, the idea that last Friday when they did this, I mean, normally you can't trace this stuff because you know it's I don't have the system I have doesn't go back and go do all that stuff. But because it was so quick, I was able to look that on Friday morning the intervention in the yen came, I think 9:30, Kevin, 9:30 Eastern time, and right after we did the show, and but a half hour before that, the futures moved in the market. So NASDAQ futures moved 500 points before the yen thing. So the right people got along, and when you catch
did
everybody.
Did you see the email I sent you about who got the memo?
Oh no, I don't know what I was doing yesterday, but I didn't see it. What did it say?
At the cabinet meeting last week, and this got photographed and shared online by several news agencies.
Oh, I saw that. I mean, the guy's notebook.
Yeah, he wrote to do buy Japanese yen, 5 to 10 billion,
and
everybody got the memo.
Well, I mean, that didn't come out for regular people until after the move. What do you do? Just leave it open for the people at the meeting to go by and see it, or what? How the hell did somebody take a picture of that?
I don't know. I'm looking at it right now from on Reuters story.
I saw it Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I think the meeting was Thursday.
Yeah, and the stuff took place Friday morning.
Yeah.
So too late for you. Just saying. Too late for you. Hey, it's going to be interesting today because Larissa's going to be on and... a couple of people might pile in, and you're certainly welcome to hang in there. I went through yesterday, when I had my truck, I went through a bunch of different definitions of economic systems.
And did you look up Hamiltonian?
Actually, I didn't, no.
Oh, okay. That's important to where we are today. But before we get into this, Tom, I want to clear up something from last week, because you and we were wondering how... who in Congress knows about how some of the expenditures and, you know, some of the covert stuff happens and what goes on with that? There is a group that's always referred to as the Gang of Eight. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, and it's the what's her name was on that forever.
It includes the House Speaker, the House Minority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader.
Oh no, I haven't heard of that. No.
Senate Minority Leader, House Intelligence Committee Chair, House Intelligence Committee Chair Ranking Member, so from the other side, the Senate Intelligence Committee Chair and the Senate Intelligence Committee Ranking Member. So it's all the highest level. These eight people are the highest level in the in Congress, both the Senate and the House. And they are... legally mandated to receive the highest level classified intelligence briefings from the executive branch, and you know the sort of the standard is that the president is required to keep the full Congressional Intelligence Committee informed, but there's extraordinary service circumstances which involves both highly sensitive or covert actions, but also. The covert actions is the important part of it. So when we are talking about things like what gets transferred around, you know, because a lot of this money is appropriated by Congress, but there's no specificity about what happens to it, and there are a lot of interagency transfers. at least in theory, significant interagency transfers, like the CIA moving dollars into gain-of-function research, would be an example of it, that those should be reported to the Gang of Eight. Whether they were or not, I don't know. There's not a lot of leaking that goes on out of the Gang of Eight. There is a lot of politicking that goes on, because there's a lot of things that these people know that nobody else knows, and then they go out in front of a microphone and completely contradict what happens to be true. So,
I guess
that's where the oversight, at least in theory, that's where the oversight.
When it comes, by the way, thank you for that, but that just brings up a whole bunch of other questions, doesn't it? Who decides whether it's a Senate or House Intelligence Committee issue or the Gang of Eight issue? And even if the Gang of Eight thinks we should spend a whole bunch of money on something, how does that not go through some kind of a committee in some form? And how do they get money out of nothing when the whole House has to do that? It brings up more questions than it answers, doesn't it?
Anything. What I'm referring to is more these how money transfers around between agencies, or how, so for instance, the CIA may transfer money into the military for some kind of covert military action. That would be an example that might come out of the CIA's budget.
I absolutely with you on that sort of. I just wonder what are the limits? I mean, you can't just come in and say, we're starting up three biolabs, by the way, here's how we're going to pay for it, and turn around and walk out. I mean, what does that do for anybody? I mean, who's the person saying that? And how do these guys get to say, no, you're not?
Can they put a stop to it is the question.
And how much, who delineates what goes to the Gang of Eight versus what goes to the regular committee? And is the committee ever told by the head of the committee, or does the head of the committee know way more than the committee? I mean, there's a million questions here, aren't there? I mean, I don't know the answers. I'm just saying, who decides what where here?
Yeah, and that's, Tom, what I just gave you is pretty cursory research,
yeah.
So I'm sure that there is a lot of literature out there that would get into a much deeper dive on this and answer some of those questions.
I just, at some point, I know...
I just wanted to bring it up because we left that as an open
issue. By the way, thank you. I mean, it just comes down to me is if you and I are in Congress and we vote a bill and we spend, and I think actually, I mean, we have people that think everybody in Congress does nothing. I actually think a lot of these people work pretty damn hard. And these bills are not that easy to do, I don't think. I mean, but I just wonder if you and I, work forever on a some sort of an intelligence budget, or are we foolish enough to give here's $10 billion, CIA, knock yourself out? I mean, they have their own banking system. They have their own. Does anybody get to see what checks they wrote? I mean, some of it has to be secret. You and I know, but who the hell gets to decide what's secret and what isn't?
Yeah, here let me tick down the three primary responsibilities. So they're responsible for covert action oversight, which means early and very restricted executive notification regarding any sensitive military operations or espionage. Okay, so they have to be told, even if Congress wasn't informed. Then national security verification is they have to evaluate the intelligence to assess whether the executive policy prescriptions, in other words, the actions, require legislative responses or not. So they can force something to go to Congress, or at least in theory they can say this is an item for Congress, or no, this can stop here. And then they have a requirement for strict secrecy, so they when they review the information, they have a pledge of absolute confidentiality, which blocks them from sharing details with the rest of Congress. So they can make a deal out of saying no administration, Mr. Ms. administration people, you have to take this to Congress, but they can't take it to Congress themselves.
If the administration says pound sand, then what?
then you wind up with a showdown, and this is where I would need to do some additional research to find out what happens then.
Whenever you ever been kind of stuck in a position like that, I was once when I was in the board of the SIBO, and they totally upgraded the retirement package and stuff from the chairman and president to something that was wildly beyond anything anybody ever dreamed of, right? I mean, it's a small change. Back in the 90s, it'd be nothing now. And I said, you know, I raised my hand and I said, guys, if the people on the floor knew this, they would be appalled. The answer was, just don't tell them. I didn't think that was quite the right answer then. And what if you get in here and you hear something totally egregious and three of the eight decide this is way inappropriate? What, they leave the room and shut their mouth and that's it?
Well, they have a pledge of secrecy, so theoretically, yes. But, you know, where does it go from there? That's an interesting question. And I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, just on a personal level, I'm sure you've been in meetings where people say this is all hush-hush, then you hear something so outrageous, you go, wait a minute. Why is that hush-hush? If anybody knew about it, you'd be out of a job, right?
Well, or you know, this one, because I've used it in ethics classes before, is suppose you know... You know that the company is going to do layoffs, and it's going to surprise a lot of people. And now you also know that someone who works for you is likely to get laid off and is thinking of buying a house. You tip them off to not do that because you're sworn to secrecy. And what if part of your sworn to secrecy says, by the way, if there's a leak about this and it's traced back to you, you go on the list of people who will be laid off.
I think the people who make those kinds of restrictions are screwed up. If they know they're going to lay somebody off in 4 weeks, they maybe should make sure that nobody buys a house. It's kind of on them. It's not up to them to tell you, and then you know about it and not tell us. They mean that maybe...
I understand, but the other side of that is that you are talking about a situation of maybe a reportable incident in terms of the market. And so once something gets leaked, it can spread like crazy, and that becomes advanced knowledge of something that's not supposed to be announced yet.
And I guess I go back to, I think what both of us feel is if the secrecy is to protect the asshole who's doing it, then it's not that kind of secrecy. I don't buy if it's real secrecy, like a military thing, a military strike. Well, that I can buy. But if it's something to protect the bozo doing it, I'm not so sure I'm up on that.
Yeah, but that's what makes it an interesting ethics question.
Yeah.
Because now you do have to balance some things that you may not like, and that's an issue everywhere you go, basically.
Well, that's right.
Whether it's government or business, it doesn't matter. That can be an issue, and so now you have that ethical balance, and that's something, you know, we could talk through for a whole show. And I have, you know, I've got a million of these ethics cases because I, you know, when I've taught business ethics, I start each class with one or more ethics challenges and say, let's talk about these before we get into the material today. And that's, you know, it really is, it's what makes it an interesting class because, I get students all the time who say, wow, this has been a real eye opener because you get into the day-to-day things and sometimes they're big things like, you know, layoffs are coming. Sometimes they're small things. And, what I always refer to as everyday ethics, the kinds of things that we just have to deal with all the time. And that, you know, it's a little more complicated than just saying I'm going to get to go out and do my job every day. You're also going to be confronted with all kinds of choices to make, and choices get a little bit harder when you can't afford to be fired. When you got to feed the kids this week, or, you know, or you're okay this week, but, you know, if you don't have a job by next week, that you've got some problems with the family budget. Now your ethical choices. Now, I'm not saying that's the case in Congress, because they've all gotten rich by now. That's how they got to those top leaderships in the first place, or that happened along the way to getting to those top leadership positions. But, you know, when it comes to the business, you know, sometimes your personal circumstances are going to drive a hell of a lot of your decision making on ethics.
Well, he was certainly never my favorite, Lindsey Graham, but he didn't do that. He didn't have much money when he died.
No, he really didn't, or at least as far as we know. You know, everybody always said that about the elder Mayor Daley too, until we found out about, you know, some of the property ownership and such that he had. But nevertheless, I don't think he was. I don't think he was. You know, filthy rich or anything like that.
It doesn't seem like he was the guy doing the trade in the day on the stuff, or he should have. I don't think he even traded, did he?
Not to my knowledge. But in Graham's case, he's sort of an exception for someone who got to some high-ranking positions. But of course, Graham, you know, he never married. He only had his sister in the family because his parents died. He actually raised his sister.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was creating generational wealth for a family. So as long as he was happy with his lifestyle, what was in it for him to just try and make a ton of money? Well, we need more people like that. We need.
I tell you what, some of the people
with no other interest other than no other financial interest other than just getting through today.
This is not an accusation, but an observation. You're talking like a regular ethical guy. If you knew some of these people, like I have, I didn't know Lindsey Graham, but I knew Kevin, they could have $40 billion, and the next penny is as important to them as the first penny, and they never let up.
And it's like in Chinatown when Jake Giddies is talking to... what was John Huston's character's name? Come on.
I know. A long time ago.
You know, yeah. How much you're worth? And, I think the questioning, I won't have the exact quote. Says, how much you're worth? 10 million? 20 million? He goes, oh, my, much more. And then, Jack Nicholson's character, Jake, looks at him and says, well, then how much more can you buy? And he just looks back at him and he says, the future.
Yeah.
You know, the future. I'm buying the future.
Yeah, the whole idea that you think, you know, because Goldman Sachs has nothing but money and influence, that some firms like that can't wait to put a guy out and kick money stocks at a discount to Citadel, or probably all up 20% from them. They do it because that's what they do, Kevin. They love it.
And when you say the future, you know, that's, you know, I go back and I've referred to this many a time, both online and offline. That if you read World Economic Forum documents, and you know specifically, I recommend that to our listeners that they should pick up a copy of Klaus Schwab's book, COVID-19, The Great Reset. There is this vision of the future that they're trying to implement. It's John Flanagan comes on Mondays and talks about, you know, globalists and the role of globalists. There is a whole point of view and a whole approach to economics, and you are getting a lot of pushback. That's one of the things out of this out of the Trump administration that's interesting, because they're getting a strong pushback on globalist policies from them, and that's not making a lot of people happy around the world, heck, this goes back to, you know, even a year old. There's a really good speech a year old to the Innovation Forum from J.D. Vance, and he talks about, you know, what we've done with globalist policies, where we've outsourced so much to cheap labor, and, you know, part of the theory behind it is that we can outsource the labor and keep the innovation. And that has been folly. But in addition to that, it's theoretically supposed to raise up some of these other countries, and if you do it according to a controlled plan, which gets into how much control do you want to impose from the from a global perspective versus a national perspective, because this administration's policy clearly is it's going to be America first. If it's not in America's interest, they don't want to do it.
Well, that's what they're telling you.
No, it's what they're doing.
Well, maybe. I mean, I find it very, well, whatever. But there's somewhere along the line, Kevin, there's economic differences in the idea that somebody someplace works for somewhat less isn't necessarily a big problem, as long as they're not, you know, enslaving people like they sort of are in China. I mean, if you had a certain state, for instance, that had a lot of people that, you know, for whatever reason aren't, you know, the agriculture is down or whatever, there's a reason why even in this country you would put an auto plant, say, in Alabama or someplace. Because probably, if you look at the supply and demand of labor, I took a whole course in this, for God's sake, of course nobody pays any attention to it now. Labor is like any other good. I mean, you're probably going to be able to get, for instance, even now in some areas where, upstate New York, which used to have, you know, this kind of manufacturing, that kind of manufacturing, and don't really anymore, you probably could plop a factory down there and hire people. We're not talking China, but we're maybe $2 less an hour than you could in a place that where everybody's fully employed. I mean, you're not going to put an auto plant in Silicon Valley, right? And try and hire people. I mean, it just wouldn't be the right spot for it. There's some of that is somewhat legit. I mean, in terms of, I mean, if you have an area, you know, just like the guys are doing the crypto farming. I mean, you're going to put your plant next to the Grand Coulee Dam, for God's sake, and run it at night because you have a power advantage. I mean, all this stuff, just because somebody's working for a little less someplace doesn't mean you took advantage. You took advantage of a situation, but you didn't necessarily take advantage of, you know, to where it's criminal. You know what I'm saying?
Now, I understand. Two points, though, that I want to make about this. So one is, the second one I'll make is on point to what you just said. The first one I will make is just in general. And that is that we've always, you know, that part of the theory behind outsourcing is we'll take the cheap labor, we'll keep the innovation here, we will skill up our workforce to a technology workforce, which, you know, hasn't really happened very much. Vance kind of derisively said, or more importantly, we'll tell everybody to learn to code. But ultimately, the point is that innovation will travel to where production is. So there's two kinds of innovation, product innovation and process innovation. And they're both important, and I might even argue that process innovation is even more important. But product innovation, we've held on to a greater degree in this country by being the inventors of things, the ones with the new ideas. But a lot of that has traveled to where the production is, because it worked. The process behind product innovation tends to travel very well. The more, you know, the less distance it has to travel. So that's part one. But the process innovation part is that's absolutely going to happen. That's going to exist where we produce. And that's process innovation is how you do things more efficiently, how you do them better, how you get leaner, all of those kinds of things. So that's part one. And so over the decades of outsourcing labor, we've lost a lot of innovation and just farmed out the innovation to other parts of the world. But part two is that in that process, we've hollowed out the middle class. And that's where, you know, when we talk about K-shaped economies, that's a big reason for it, is that we have just outsourced so many of those jobs. And the ones that we didn't, with the recent allowance for, let's stay away for now, because we'll wind up you know, going back and forth the whole show, but I think we can both agree that there is this phenomenon of a lot, we've imported a lot of labor, a lot of cheap labor into this country, that a lot of it is off the books, so it's really cheap labor. It might not be slave labor, it might not be China, but it is below what market wages would be. And so we have managed to, how do I want to say it? We have managed to do a lot of that same kind of hollowing out the middle class, we've hollowed out the middle class. Now what we're doing with the cheap labor is we're hollowing out the entry level as well by, you know, pushing those jobs to people who are off book. And, you know, I think that's a real problem, too, for this economy.
Well, I think it's a problem, but it's also... When you look at the theory of what happened here, because God bless, I was sitting around in grad school when all these policies were kind of put forward. I mean, and we keep using the we word, you know, who's we? I mean, if we wanted to, if
we use the United States.
Okay. Well, when you say to go back to where you started with the process. Okay, let's pick one. Let's pick Levi's. Okay. They make blue jeans. Okay, well, the labor is cheaper over in China, so it reaches the point where we don't make any blue jeans here. They make it all over there. Well, obviously, any sort of innovation in the making of blue jeans isn't going to happen here because we're not making any. I mean, duh. I mean, I think we all figure that out. But when the people like Milton Friedman that have been totally denigrated by allegedly supporting these policies, when they opined that if this were to happen, they didn't really say China, because I don't think they had a big warm and fuzzy for China, but they thought, you know, say Mexico. Well, okay, if a firm goes over to, like I used my example earlier, Alabama versus Silicon Valley for an auto plant, well, the rules of engagement in this country to a huge extent are going to follow, the rules are the same in Alabama to a large extent as they would be in Silicon Valley. Okay. Well, now, when you go to China, the first thing you do is our saintly people that do this stuff. First thing they do is they get somebody in the political party that they pay off. Because I was, you know, I actually went through this with a person that I introduced to the Chinese embassy here, and you get a guy, okay, who helps you find the place, do the stuff, and oh, by the way, you pay him. So essentially, you got a political graft politician, and you've got him that makes sure you never have a labor problem. Okay, well, that's not the same set of rules. So you're essentially paying off a government. I mean, you're paying bribes to keep the labor where you want it. And at the end of the day, I don't know if the bribe is so big that maybe you could pay people more. I mean, who knows? But the fact is, that's not what Friedman and these guys anticipated, that you were going to have this total sort of I don't even know what you call that, Kevin, but I mean it, but that's, so when you talk about those guys, you don't think that the people from Apple and all these places, how do you think the people in the Communist Party over there make all this money?
Well, I absolutely think that especially with you know, China, as it pertains to China, but as it also pertains to a lot of places. I mean, we've had, you know, there's some great reports out there that, you know, go back quite a ways about, you know, production in Malaysia and how workers are treated there and how substandard the working conditions are. So it isn't just that. But, yeah, you're not going to be able to tell me that a major corporation has completely outsourced production and that they aren't going to send high-level people to look in on what's happening there once in a while. Somebody is going to go, and they're going to want to walk into the factory, and they're going to want to see how it's producing, that it's producing according to specifications, and so on. So they know that, you know, they can feign interest they can feign ignorance all that they want and how surprised they are to see what the conditions are, and maybe they're cleaned up for scheduled visits a little bit, but nevertheless, they know damn well what's going on, and they do it anyway.
We don't want to walk down this COVID road again because we've been beating that up lately, but I remember, Kevin, when the thing first happened, and I don't know who came up with it. Was it me or was it you? Kind of so long ago. somebody came up with a list of major companies that had stuff in Wuhan province, and actually it was in Milan, and how they knew how many people there were sick, and they were still sending people from here over there on business trips. You know, you got to go to Wuhan next week for a business trip. You know, isn't everybody dying over there? Yeah, so what? People knew there was a problem, and they still sent people over there for trips.
Could we at least give them a mask?
Yeah, or do something. I mean, the incredible stuff people will do for money. I mean, I saw that, you know, Phil Tilt on the trading floor, and people traded for themselves. It was your reputation that was you know, and this is all perfect world. This is not, you know, Andy Mayberry stuff. But it was your reputation. As soon as everybody worked for somebody else, you know, if you had an out trade with somebody, well, let's split it. I got to ask my boss. What do you mean? Your boss wasn't here. It was you and me. We're talking about $500. You think you're right. I think I'm right. What do you say we make it 250? Oh, no, I got to ask my boss. He'll never approve that. Your boss wasn't here. I mean, the amount of lying people will do for an administration, no matter which one it is, the amount of lying people will do for their company when their people would never lie to you on the golf course, probably. I mean, it's amazing what people will do for other people. You know, when you talk about the ethics stuff, I just want to say something real quick. It's something I've involved on is through life. One of my most influential teachers at Notre Dame was a guy named Father Fitzgerald. I don't know if you ever had him. He taught... He's why I have such a dim view of patents, because all he did was talk about how the best patents really weren't the people who invented the stuff. And he was a labor arbitrator and a mediator, and one of the best, evidently. The guy lived to like 107 or something, because he was old when I was there, and he died like 2 years ago. But he would say that whenever he had a big arbitration or someplace, he would go to a town, he'd make his own airfare, he'd grab a cab, go to a hotel, a motel where they never thought he was staying in, you know, probably one with the leave the light on or something. He'd go down, have a beer and a hamburger, and instead if a free beer showed up, he'd walk to the phone before cell phones, he'd call the people and say, I've been compromised, I'm out. And I always thought, God, there's a guy where there was no gray. It was black or white with this dude. But as time went on, I'm sitting there going, okay, he's a priest. You know, he's got the vow of poverty and all this kind of stuff. All he had to do was get back on the plane and go back to Notre Dame, teach. You know, he had three hots and a cot, and, you know, wasn't jail, but he had a life. What if he had a family?
That's exactly true, yeah. And that's, we wrestle with that in the classroom for just that reason, that, you know, your other obligations in your life tend to do it. So, you know, it is much easier for me to be hardline ethical at my age with, you know, nobody needs me to feed them. It is much easier for me to be hardline ethical than it would have been 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, and it comes down to, I mean, you know, people are going to, I mean, you see it in politics all the time. You see people, I don't know how they keep a straight face when they say stuff when they know it's wrong. I mean, we're not talking one side or the other. I'm sitting there going, how can that guy do that? Well, you get this idea, and some of it's legit, Kevin. I mean, some of it is, I really think that if I'm the senator from, you know, butt state, that the state and the country is better off, because I'm generally a bright, honest guy. And all of a sudden, someday you're saying something that maybe isn't all that true, and you say, well, you know, that's the price you have to pay for me being here, because if I wasn't here, it's this little white liar, this little whatever piece of BS. It's okay, because I got my eye on the goal, is that if I'm here, I'll make it all up to everybody because I'm better than the guy or the lady I'm running against. And you, everybody's going to take that a little bit. The question is how much.
Well, and that's, you know, that's part of the conceit that goes into the the perspectives. That's, you know, as you read something like The Great Reset, it's really saying, we know better for how people should live. We know what's good for people. So it is up to us, the elite people, the enlightened people, to impose the structure on the rest of the world. And, you know, when we talk about you know, when you hear the term globalist, and by the way, you know, speak, because John has raised it a number of times on here, way more than I have. John did text us and say that the John Huston character was Noah Cross.
Yeah,
I would have racked my brains for a little, quite a while on that, or I would have been looking it up. But you know, so I think you're right that that's part of the conceit of being one of the elites. And then when you get down to the everyday type of level, the ethical compromises get much more personal. Like, you know, how am I, you know, what am I going to feed my kids next month if I take a hard line now and wind up getting fired over it? Now, everybody, you know, universally, people will agree that there are some things that they just won't do no matter what the pain is. But, you know, otherwise, you know, it gets to be a pretty interesting conversation when you start saying you have to project this into your personal circumstances and now think about it. But if you haven't thought about it in advance, man, when you're confronted with some of these issues, it's really difficult.
Well, I think the idea, you know, when we're going to talk about the, and you're welcome to hang in there, by the way. I mean, what are these different? I mean, we're moving as fast as we can into some kind of plutocracy here, where the people, the elites, not only think that they run the place, and it, you know, when Trump's gone, it'll be somebody else they compromise. But they really do believe that you know, the people like Musk and that whole group, and it wasn't always just people like him. It was Harold Janine years ago. It was people who really felt that they had a better way, that politics and governments were just sort of in the way. Because look how smart they are, look how much money they got. And by the way, the newspaper doesn't like them. Well, that's okay, I'll buy the newspaper. I mean, that's clearly where we're heading. And I don't know, I mean, I don't think it's a left or right issue. It's some sort of a, and somehow the rest of the people got to find a way to say, well, no, that's not what we want. And there's like more of us than them. But I mean, somehow, right now it looks to me they're winning. I mean, and they clearly are controlling the market in a lot of ways. I mean, the wealth. I mean, we're talking about, you know, I mean, for God's sake, Larissa sent me a thing where she went through a whole PowerPoint for her class, and we'll talk about it a little bit, on school supplies this year versus last year, and how this is up X percent, this is up that percent, and she did a terrific job on this. Do you think any of these people who made, you know, $1 trillion in the market yesterday give a crap what Larissa thinks? I mean, really? do they care about back to school? Why would they? I mean, we have created, and the thing that I constantly am talking about on this show, and because I'm bewildered myself, how does this kind of money just come out of thin air in value in one day or 4 days? This is the single biggest rally, Kevin. I don't think I've seen a rally like this, and the only thing that even comes close to it was when the first Iraq war ended in like one night, and the market was getting kind of drilled, thinking it was going to go on forever, and all of a sudden, what, it took like 2-3 days before it was obvious we were winning. I mean, those guys had nothing. And by the way, we lost some people, but maybe not as many as people feared, and all of a sudden the market rallied back up. But there was a legitimate reason for that. It was down because what the hell are we doing here? And all of a sudden, you know, it was over, and, you know, we gained all that back plus a little bit. But this is just, guess what? We're pouring money in, and this is the way we're going. And any time you do that, you're gonna see the flip side, the inflation side, banging other people. But the trade off on a daily basis, do you think anybody who had some Palantir stock yesterday gives a rat's ass about Larissa's study about school supplies? I mean, really?
Well, they should, damn it.
I know, but. I mean, if you just made $400,000 on your stock yesterday, are you really going to care if the wife comes in and says, "You know, the blue jeans cost 4% more than last year?" Really? You might pacify her, but you're, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's at some point the levels we're talking about here are so different. I've never seen like it. I've never seen anything like it. I don't think it's ever been like this. Although I guess maybe in 1929, some guy who had a bunch of stock in Wall Street, compared to like a farmer who was going under. I mean, I guess, you know, that was sort of the same sort of difference, but the money isn't even the same, is it? I mean, these people have, you know, they could have $1,000 bills in their pocket, and they'd still have more than you have ones. I mean, they're almost right, and we need a $250 bill. Of course, nobody will ever cash it, but for you, but the I don't know if I want Trump's face on it, but with a hundo, you light your, some of these guys lighting their cigar with a hundo is like chump change, isn't it?
Yep. So we have the other guests are on, yeah. So we should bring them into the conversation.
Yeah, let's do that. Larissa, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
How are you? Yeah. We've been talking about you for a week.
Oh, goodness.
We had some, by the way, who else is on?
I'm here. Morning, Kevin.
Hey, John.
Larissa.
What I wanted to do is we had so many people are accusing everybody of being this, that, and the other thing. I actually wanted to go through and define what some of the, what these different economic systems allegedly by Webster, anybody remember him, and what we're seeing today. And it's funny, when the term socialist came up, I know you guys all know this, I don't know if the rest of the people do, you know what the term Nazi Party stood for?
Yeah.
You do. National Socialist German Workers' Party. Did anybody think for a second that those guys were socialist or for the workers?
Literally opposed to the communists, supposedly.
Yeah, but I'm saying they were somebody who was against the communists, but they weren't socialists under any stretch, were they? How?
I don't, that's a point to explore, maybe. I don't know.
Well, that's kind of what I want to. And we have, you know, Kevin, or, well, Kevin knows a lot of this. So Larissa is the economics professor who's kind of teaching this to people. And we have, what are we here? And just to say that when you talk about socialists versus capitalists, I think you sort of have to define kind of where we are now. But if you look at the big difference between socialism and capitalism by Webster, is that in capitalism, individual people own stuff, property, and there's laws to, there's property rights, those kinds of things. We could own a factory, okay? Where socialism, strict socialism, says no, the government, the communal place, owns the factory. All right, so the only real example of socialism that I can think of, and you guys, I'm going to say maybe a kibbutz or something like that, where nobody owns anything, you just work and everybody works.
Not exactly, Tom.
Well, but I'm saying that's something, it's never really exactly, that's my point.
As, you know, in a socialist society, you would, individuals can still own, you know, like their own private property, communism would take it a step farther and say everything's collectively owned. So when you look at a kibbutz, you're looking at more of a communist type of situation.
Okay, but my point is, when we go back to the definitions, actually, what you're saying is what I'm saying. None of these, nobody's accusation of somebody being a socialist or a capitalist, if you actually look at the terms, they're not, the big difference between the two is who owns the stuff. All right, so we have people, and I'm going to get Larissa into this, we have people in this country that are running essentially as socialists, and yet I don't think they have any idea that they're going to take the factory away from Joe and give it to the U.S. I mean, I don't even think they know what a socialist is. that's sort of my point. And when you talk about capitalism, we have, and here's one, if I really want to open this up, and I will, here's the definition of a fascist economic system. And a fascist economic system has sort of companies where the government has a piece of them, so it's a little bit socialist. And also, they love tariffs for whatever reason, but it's a whole different, I mean, what we're seeing is from this administration, and again, this is not an accusation of where they essentially want, they or the government or whatever, they want to take a piece of a lot of the companies that they do business with. And I say they, the U.S. of A. Well, that's actually incredibly socialist, not capitalist at all. And yet, most people would think that the current group is very capitalist. Listen, where am I? I don't know where I'm going with this, but just in terms of definition, does anybody even know these definitions?
Well, I'll let John and Larissa go, and then I want to come back at something on that. So all right. Go ahead. You two should go first.
He's going to hang, so...
Oh, good, 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 good. Yay. Yeah, I think we have a broad idea of what some of these different definitions are. I think the nuances are challenging. I also think younger people struggle to understand the impact of some of these things. So on the surface, socialism and communism doesn't sound bad, right? The idea that we all have equal access to things, we all have that the government takes care of us, but in practical terms, these systems start to fall apart because people have a desire to get more and to want more. And we also have different scenarios where we're in situations such as you were talking about the Nazi Party. Part of the reason why the Nazi Party was able to take off so quickly was because the people had experienced a considerable amount of depression in their economic system, and then they had a substantial amount of inflation. So these people at the time were desperate. They were desperate to be able to do things like eat. And I think in our society now, we don't really think about those things because these are not things that we're truly concerned about. Yes, there is a subsection of our population that is, but for most Americans, that this is not something that crosses our mind, that I won't have enough resources to be able to eat or have a place to sleep. And I think that then muddles some of these definitions and makes it difficult, particularly for younger people, to really understand how those societies would look. Again, it's always interesting because I have taught economics at the undergraduate level before, and we talk about the difference between communism and capitalism, and I would easily say about 60% of the class say, well, communism sounds really great, that perhaps we should have a system like that. And again, part of that is just their lack of understanding of the overall implications of what that truly means.
Well,
yeah, I always say is communism is what happens when socialism stops working.
Well, let me lab a quick one out there, and I'll try and be brief to just sort of define a system. When I went to Dr. J and I, because we had a third wheel with us, but we went over and did some lecturing in Austria and in Germany, and we were at the now dear departed Dresdner Bank, which got taken over by Deutsche Bank. Well, the German economics, the system over there, and by the way, I can't name this, so I'm hoping one of the three of you can. I could name it. I could say it was disgusting, but that's one man's opinion. You went over, and it was a trading group. Now, at the time, you know, the floors here were very, very vibrant. I mean, if you wanted to be a trader, you worked for somebody, and either they backed you, or you plucked 25 grand in an account, you put a badge on, and off you went. And to me, it was absolutely the perfect economic world. Anybody could get in if you wanted to. We opened up a brokerage firm with four people. We all took the test, and here we opened it up. There was no barrier to entry whatsoever. Well, I go over to Germany, and every trader worked for a bank. They sat in a big room. They didn't trade for themselves. They could never have traded for themselves. You work for somebody else. The law firms, I talked to one kid who was going to law school. Sorry, Mr. Flanagan. He said, you know, I'm never going to be anything until I'm like 40 or 45, and then maybe they'll make me a partner if I kiss ass the whole way, basically. I mean, there's no way we and two or three buddies can open up a law firm and actually be thought of in any court of being anything, even if we're pretty good lawyers. And it even got so bizarre, Larissa, this is sort of bizarre. We went to this street fair, and, you know, of course, it's German street fair. The place is spotless, and there's no such thing as a paper cup. And you know, the girls from the bank are there, and I said to all of a sudden, I see these old guys walking by with all these young girls. So me being the big mouth that I am, I said to the one girl, I go, you know, I love this. This is a very family event. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, all these dads with their daughters. And she looks me right in the eye, and she goes, German girls like guys with money, and the old guys got the money. And I look, I mean, no lady here would ever say that to you. But she was flat out, what are you talking about? They got the dough, and we don't want to go out with guys without any dough. The young guys were like the young guys sort of today I see here. They got really no hope of a future. None of them owned a car. They were, they had, one of them, no one were ever going to be a trader. And it, I don't know what that's, the banks owned 50, 60, 70% of the stock in all the big companies, and the banks had the nose right up the ass of government, or the nose, the government had the nose up the ass of the bank. And I look at the system and I go, I can't even define this. It's not socialism, it's not capitalism, but it kind of really sucks if you're young. Now, somebody pile in here, explain to me what I saw, because it looks to me that's right where we're headed, and I don't know what it is, but I don't like it. Larissa, you go first.
Yeah, real quickly, I just got a text from a listener saying we're not picking up Larissa's volume very well, so we need to adjust that. I hear her fine on Zoom, but I don't think it's coming through.
Yeah, you're a little light. Andrew, can you goose Larissa up a little bit, or Larissa talk closer to the mic or whatever?
Yeah, I just moved the microphone.
There you go. Now you're perfect.
Yeah.
Yay.
Thank you. Sorry. There's no way for me to like adjust the volume through Zoom, so I appreciate that. It's much better.
All right, Larissa, okay. Fire off. Now, what did I see, and why does it look like we're going there, and what is it?
So I have a little bit of a different tangent. I've been to Poland a few times, and now Poland is a post-communist state, and granted, it's decades since they've been in that state. But what struck me is the mentality is still there. So individuals weren't necessarily looking to get ahead. They weren't looking to aggressively progress with their careers. It was a weird sense of, this is what it's supposed to be. There's no reason to challenge that norm. And I don't know that the United States is like that. The young people that I work with, there's, to some extent, we've discussed this on this program before, there is a bit of apathy where they look at their economic growth and think they're not going to be able to really get anywhere. And that might be most recent generations, but I know, at least with my generation and the generation behind me, that we're still looking to better ourselves, to build things for ourselves, to build wealth for ourselves, to educate ourselves, to raise our children. And I don't know if that's a societal thing, but I really do believe to some extent it's based on the economic pressures that we're having. So if you don't think that you're able to actually get out of the system, you don't think you're able to actually better yourself, then you're in a situation where you almost give up. And again, that was something that I felt in Poland, that people weren't really progressively saying, we're going to change the world, I'm going to build a better life for my family. It was more of an attitude of, this is what it is, and this is the best it's going to be, so I'm just going to accept it.
Yeah, I think that ties back to what I was saying before you and John got on, and that is that we've outsourced so much middle class activity, and you know, most people who get into, you know, whether we call it upper middle, whatever we want to call, call a class that is better off, whatever we want to call that, it is. It starts with, you know, being able to earn a comfortable living, to be able to raise a family, to do all of those kinds of things. And then, you know, it's at that point that when you have that confidence, that then aspiration can kick in. But when you don't have that confidence that you're even going to be able to create and raise a family effectively, then, yeah, you're not going to be highly motivated.
Well, and just to build what you and Tom were saying before I got on, Kevin, when there wasn't a race to the bottom for wages, that started with NAFTA and a host of other mind-blowing experiments that just kind of sent this nation on a completely different track from anything we'd ever seen, I think. It was pretty hard for corporations, especially big ones, to just have such control over wages to the extent that they could impoverish a population by being able to outsource, critical parts of their production to people in the third world who were just salivating at making 50 cents a day when they were making nothing before. And that allowed a kind of concentration of economic power that I don't think capitalism really has as its theoretical base. But it was certainly enabled by the trade policies that this country just went head over heels to enforce, and that reduced the expectations and the earning power of otherwise qualified workers in this country, and made it tough for the people coming in at the lower level, like you were saying before, Kevin, because the wages were even more debased for them. And I was thinking when you were talking, Melissa, about post-communist states. I heard one time at some conference, it wasn't a literary conference, but it was like a student honors conference, about somebody discussing the profile or the attitude of Polish immigrants in this country after they overthrew communism in Poland. And the traditional way of living with the communist state for the Poles during their tough years was to cheat the government at every possible corner you could, because they were the enemy. They were preventing you from living a happy life, practicing your religion, and whatever else. And that became inculcated in some cases, where immigrants who came here from such countries consider the government the enemy, and capable and deserving to be cheated at every possible angle. And I can't draw too many connections because I don't have any data in front of me to support any of this. But I do think there's a mindset in post-communist countries that extends to, their populations, and it's harder to eradicate that because they get used to a system that takes, no consideration of them individually at all, denies them their religion, their free will, everything, and it sours people so that they can be, converted to lots of other different belief systems once they have the freedom to think.
Well, John, you and Larissa, I think are some of it is, I use the term, Larissa, embedded in the, if you threw Putin out tomorrow and said, okay, Russia, you now have a free economic system, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. I mean, it would take them a long time to even figure out what that meant. Where in China, it's always been kind of there's always been the capitalistic open-air market kind of thing gurgling under the surface. They have a long history of being economically, I'll use the term, free, at least in some areas. I think you're right. In Poland, it had been so long. But I think, we can wander off into this idea of, a lot of it is outsourcing, which, by the way, I'm not going to disagree with, and how some of the stuff in other places, I think economically, we didn't realize that the Communist Party was going to take such a chunk out of the workers. They're the one that's taking the chunk out of the workers' pay, really. But in this country, you don't have to look overseas. Look at what's happened in my industry. Look what's happened in the medical industry. They didn't do that. We did it to ourselves. I mean, Barack Obama comes up with a plan. Does anybody even remember this? We were supposed to have insurance exchanges. We're supposed to have people competing. Well, while the ink was drying on the bill, we had, how many, somebody remembers, 75 combinations in insurance companies before it happened, to the point where, what's the point of having an exchange? There's only three people left. Well, there's more than three, but what is the point? Your doctors right now, they're the low man on the totem pole. They used to be entrepreneurs. We used to have, we had a PTI. We had four doctors groups that we managed money for. They're all gone. We don't have anybody of those people anymore, because they all had to join some group, and the group had some other deal. We've watched it. We blame it, even on the show. We blame it all on foreign bad actors. But look here. Look in the mirror. It's happening right here. I mean, is a doctor an entrepreneur anymore? I'm going to say no. Who did that? It wasn't the Chinese. Please comment, Larissa.
Well, I agree with you, Tom. And in that regard, yeah, we have, again, you go back to, okay, what's socialism? Well, it's government. It starts with government intervention into industries, and eventually moves. And I am absolutely positive that the ACA was intended to step us into a system similar to what the British have in terms of medical care, or what we like to call now euphemistically Medicare for all. But, you know, I think it was intended to step us in that direction, and it has done so. So
I think it's, it, to me, it has failed miserably, and it looks to me like the electrical companies, for God's sake, they're just becoming big. I don't think Obama envisioned four hospital networks in Chicago. I don't think he was that smart. It, that just naturally happens if you don't stop it. And
yeah, but I think a lot of the people who wrote the legislation did envision.
Well, yeah, maybe. I do too. Anyway, I got an interesting thing here regarding this seems familiar, not just here but other places. Fascist economics, which Luz brings up once in a while, is a third position system combining private property and capitalism with strict state control, featuring corporate state partnership, corporatism, economic self-sufficiency, autarky, and a suppression of labor units. Promoted primarily in 20th century Italy and Germany, it supports all economic activity to national and military power. But it sounds familiar in a few countries, doesn't it? Industries and workers are organized into state-controlled associations or corporations to mediate class conflict and dictate production. Autarky regimes push for national self-sufficiency. Boy, that sounds familiar. Heavily using tariffs, protectionism, and import limits to avoid foreign economic dependence and preservation of private property. Unlike communism, fascism allowed, well, they allowed non-Jewish capitalists and industrials to keep private property and make profits, provided they serve the state's national and military interests. That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, a different version of that, and this is why I brought it up earlier, because not only is it a somewhat different version of it, that if you were to sit down and listen to any long interview with either J.D. Vance or Scott Bessent, they refer to Hamiltonian economics a lot. And Hamiltonian, this goes back to Hamilton's vision, early in the history of the United States. Now, in his case, they wanted to transform the United States from an agricultural nation into a self-sufficient industrial power. And, now I think the mission in their mind is that we have to rekindle the industrial power. And they're not worried about being an agricultural nation as much as they are in the industry out of there. So this is, heavily leaning on government subsidies and incentives. Tariffs were a huge part of it. Infrastructure investment was a huge part of it. Direct federal funding for internal for infrastructure investment was a huge part of it, and then strong central finance, which included managing the national debt, which apparently is not part of it at the moment. And there was radical and regional reprioritization that is part of that. A lot of the burden shifting and allied alignment. When you talk about burden shifting, this is a lot of what's going on with NATO right now. Cultural sovereignty, obviously, a big issue, and even became a bigger issue with the stuff that happened last week in Spain. And definitely technological dominance is part of what the policy is about now. We are totally racing on computing power with the Chinese to try and be dominant. And and a lot of this is getting pushed through Department of War acquisition strategy. So they're trying to kickstart the production in the United States through the military. There's a lot of those aspects of it. Now, like I said, they cite it in interviews as their approach. So to the extent that it actually is the approach, I think it's important to know what they're talking about when they say it.
Yeah, what's your comment on all this? When you talked about, who's the they, I guess, if we go down that road, but... why would somebody? I guess my what I'm saying here is somebody who wants everybody to get Medicare pricing. They call themselves a socialist, but they're not really. I mean, that's not. I mean, I guess why do you think people use definitions that they don't even? I don't even think they know what they are. Do any of these people running as socialists actually want to take all the? They don't seem to me like they want any part of taking a business and giving it to the government. I mean, that's the big tenet of socialism. So, Larissa, when you talk in class, what do people even think about this stuff?
Well, it's Medicare in particular is interesting because of the amount of rules and regulations surrounding it. So I think, and I could be very wrong here, but I think a lot of people think of Medicare as almost government handouts. But there are so many stipulations about your salary requirements, proof of things, and where you can go, what the reduction of price is, that it's much more complex and complicated than what we would normally think about these things. And as a result, when we start to think about Medicare and Medicaid in particular, like all of these things, it's having somebody who really understands the rules and regulations, because those things, once they're violated, people are missing out on opportunities and resources. And the way the system is set up right now, there are many opportunities that people just lose. So it seems like it's going to be a great idea. It's things like it's going to be it's going to distribute assets and distribute healthcare across the board, but that's not how it ends up being implemented in reality, and I think that's a big challenge for us at the moment.
Why does a conversation, you know, let's pick on medical care for a while. I mean, to me it's so simple, and when I say simple, nothing simple. It's so simple on both sides. This one will argue, one side will argue, you know, Medicare is this and that, and somebody else will, everybody. To me, being, you know, my cost accountant background, I don't care what the bleep, who you force to pay for something. If you're paying $20 for a pill that costs $1 to make, I don't care what you do with it. The fact is, there's $19 there that shouldn't be there. I mean, whether you and I pay for it when we go to the doctor, or the government pays for it, or insurance company pays for it, you can shove the shell all you want all over the place, but the fact is, it's too much dough. I mean, I don't care, and it seems like all the debate is who else we can get to pay for it, when in fact, it's the price that's the problem. And those people seem to control Congress on both sides. We never can go down that road. Why is that? I mean, I know we talk about it way too much, but why is that? Why doesn't everybody realize that's the goddamn problem?
Well, I know we've discussed many times just the economic cost of developing these drugs.
According to them.
Pardon me?
According to them.
I have no information that would point against what they're saying, but also for our doctors, the amount of insurance that they have to cover, the amount of excess overhead costs can become very expensive, which goes to your point of why we're losing some of those medical groups, because if each one of these medical groups is responsible for paying out or paying the premiums for these types of policies, then it becomes cost prohibitive.
Well, I mean, this comes down to when you talk about listening to politicians. God, I'm getting so cynical as I'm getting older. I listen to these drug companies. They're so full of crap. I'm gonna say that Viagra, which they managed to get another 2 years on the patent. So they made it out to 19 years instead of 17. How they pull that off, maybe that's a John Flanagan question. But I'm going to say they spent more on advertising in the last month of their patent, when they still had the patent, than they ever paid to develop it in the first place. So if I'm going to listen to some guy telling me he's got to charge $50 for a pill that costs, the other people are making money on it, $5 because of the cost of development, Larissa, I just can't go there. I mean, I'm too old of a cat to get screwed by a kitten, for God's sake. I mean, really? I mean, how much is the guy making a year? I mean, what are we talking about here? I mean, there's some. I agree that it's a great story, but is it true?
I don't have any data to say if it's true or not true.
Well, but we're a nation of believers. You know, we believe to a certain extent. We believe our politicians, even if most of them lie through their teeth. We believe corporate guys on top, even though I don't know if they deserve to be believed. I mean, what are we doing here? I mean, do we really? If you were to come out tomorrow, you know, our little group here is pretty bright. If we came out tomorrow and said, okay, we're going to find a way where if you had a new drug, we're going to find this system where you can get it tested and get through the thing at, it's going to cost you $5 million. Who do you think would be the most outraged? Don't all speak at once.
Okay. Well,
you think would, Tom, you think Pfizer would like that?
Yeah, we would have to start down the road of solutions, and I don't know that that's what you want to do right now, especially given the time that we have.
Yeah,
so,
but I'm saying these are all sort of the same picture.
Solutions for this before, probably the biggest one is that patent protection lasts so long. Not that we have it, because you can make a case that patents are what allow for a lot of pure research. Although there was a about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago or so, the administration just did some changes in how it intends to fund research. Let me see if I can find that. That particular document that I saved away, basically they are trying to move more towards research that is directed at what will get to market rather than just doing peer research. And it has this was news in the wake of everything that we've learned about the that Fauci documented for us, thankfully, in his diary. Thank you, Dr. Fauci. It was very insightful. How much research should be funded that's directed, and how much should just be pure research, and where should the funding for each one, what should be the source for funding for each one? Because if something's not going to make it to market, and we're just doing it just to see, and there's a whole lot of examples of that, that we come up with, then what's the value to it, what's not the value to it, and that is now spurring a hot debate amongst people who actually are involved in research, mostly through universities, but not necessarily entirely through universities. So but to bring this back to medical spending, the idea behind it is that there's more failures than there are success stories in like drug research, and if we don't get patent protection on the success stories, then we will have to curtail all of the other research that goes on, and we'll never get the spectacular discoveries that we get all the time now. That's the theory behind it.
That's the story. I also got a bridge for you.
Well, I think there might be elements of truth to that, and I'm not willing to dismiss it out of hand. I'm willing to allow for some patent protection. I'll give you 5 years, but I'm not going to give you 17.
Well, Larissa, if you're going to redo the again, it's a very complicated subject, which I think you've, by the way, your answers have taken me even more complicated, so I blame you. When you talk about this sort of thing, when you talk about any sort of patent protection, if it's for a hula hoop, okay, if anybody remembers what that is, so what? If somebody prices the hula hoop at $50, they're not going to sell any anyway. But it's not a question of life or death. I mean, at some point, even in a patent protection, should there be, and boy, I hate like hell to get government involved in anything, but you can't just do one thing. I mean, you go back to the railroads. Okay, well, we gave everybody land to build a railroad, okay? So now they build a railroad. There's no roads, so They go to the farmer and they say, "Hey, can you ship my corn for me?" "Yeah, how much?" "Well, how much you got?" You can't give anybody that kind of power. I mean, what could Salk have charged for polio vaccine even if he had it for 6 months? He could have charged a year's salary for every parent in the country, and they would have paid, wouldn't they, Larissa? I mean, is there some limit to how much it costs for you to make the damn thing versus... Now, if there's some research involved, I mean, every time you walk down this road, yeah, you don't have 17 years for Viagra. Of course, Viagra was more of a voluntary thing, but if you don't have 17 years for Viagra, you got five. All right, does that mean it's 500 a pill? I mean, how much? At what point? And now you add the other layer in it that most people don't pay for it. Insurance does. They don't pay for it directly, but they do in the end. I mean, this gets very, very complicated. And that's why, when we talk about, matter of fact, I'll go back to the theme here today. The essential feature of capitalism is the motive to make a profit. As Adam Smith said, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from that regard to their own interests. Both parties to a voluntary exchange transaction have their own interests in the outcome, but neither can obtain what he or she wants without addressing what the other wants. It is a rational self-interest that can lead to economic prosperity. Now, the problem with that is, once government gets involved with a patent or other thing, it throws a wrench in this whole thing, doesn't it? I mean, it all of a sudden the definitions become very skewed. So, I don't know, we're not doing solutions here, but we're trying to figure out what we're dealing with. So if you can
to some extent, we are dealing specifically with that problem for specific types of heart medication. Now, I'm not currently taking any of these heart medications, but from my understanding, there's some medications out there that, to some extent, really are life or death. And this has hit a subsection of the population that needs the heart medication, so more mature adults. And
thank you for wording it that way.
Yeah. She didn't say you old farts.
No, but it's a group of people that, in their own rights, are vulnerable. They're living in a very fixed income situation. They might be drawing down on a pension. Hopefully they have a 401k. They might be solely relying on Social Security. And yet their medication for life-saving drugs is unaffordable. I know of somebody who needed some of these medications, and what their doctor did was give out free samples to the patient as a way to mitigate the cost for the patient. And then the doctor came back and said, you know what, I have to start to reduce some of these samples. I'm not getting as many samples as I used to.
Well, yeah, that's going the way of the dodo bird, the sample stuff.
Pardon me?
That's going the way of the dodo bird, where every doctor had a huge cabinet of stuff he could give you.
Right. And for some patients, that meant life or death if they could get that free sample. This patient in particular had the financial means to be able to pay for it. So this patient said, no, I'm going to pay for it. Please give the samples to somebody else so that somebody who's in financial dire straits can have access to the medication. And this then becomes a deeper question of just pure economics, but of morals. How do we decide which group of people are going to have the life-saving medication and which group of people are not?
Well, I'll give you...
I want to frame that. I frame a couple issues around that because I think that's a really, really good example that you raise. And so why are there fewer samples out there? Because the doctors, as Tom said earlier, there are fewer medical practices in general. Everybody's gone corporate now. And so, they had samples because they would constantly get calls from pharmaceutical salespeople, and now they don't get those calls anymore because those are going to the corporate level, which it's corporate who's telling the doctors whether they should, what they can and can't prescribe during the COVID nonsense, you know, what they would lose, you know, licenses for prescribing, and what they would, you know, be kicked out of medical practice for prescribing. So it can get pretty serious in terms of the level of control that comes there. And now we've seen the integration of pharmaceutical companies having ownerships in medical providers. So, you know, it's even worse. And this throws us back into the, okay, as we start discussing economic systems, does this mean that we're almost, you know, into that socialist economic model? And if we are, and it's not working well because there's no affordability for these medications because we don't have a competitive market, then are we really now talking about Medicare for all? Because that's the result of this kind of a market arrangement that shouldn't be allowed to exist.
Okay, let me give you a specific example. Tonight I'm meeting, and Mr. Flanagan's always invited, meeting with the remnants of the old Mike Tooman group, his group of pals, guys that retired attorneys and judges and stuff. And I'm going to guess that out of the probably 8 guys that show up, 5 of them at least are on Eliquis or Xarelto, which are blood thinners. And some of them had a heart attack and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to say Eliquis has been out on the market for, Mr. Flanagan, help me here, 15, 14 years. So it's pushing the end of its patent. If you're on Medicare Part, because these guys tell me all this stuff, if you're on Medicare Part D, your share on the year is like $3,000 and Medicare is $3,000 because you got the big deductible and then there's the hole and all the other crap with Medicare that I don't fully understand. But the bottom line is, it's $3,000 to $3,500 out of your pocket on somebody who has Social Security. All right, so we're talking Social Security is probably, what, $2,000 a month, say $40,000 a year. So it's, you know, it's 8% of your basket right out of the gate for one drug. And I've read, of course, you can't believe any of this crap, that it actually costs the company somewhere in a neighborhood of $300-$400 a year. And somebody's paying $6,000. You know, if maybe the government's paying half, you're paying half, the other insurance company, somebody. And my point is, somewhere our system has allowed this to, quote, happen. And I don't care what you do, you can have some young guy who looks like he's from another country say he's a socialist and he wants the government to pay for more of it, or somebody else says, no, we're capitalists and blah, blah, blah. The fact is, the difference is the $200 versus the $6,000. And unless you address that, all this rest is just jaw-jagging is all it's doing. I mean, I don't know. Listen, tell me.
The thing I noticed, you know, being an elderly person now and on a drug therapies for various conditions, I think we kind of allowed our research to, you know, explore areas where it's determined that things like AFib or, you know, conditions that were not even recognized, say, 50, 60 years ago, are now treatable with, you know, lifelong retinues of blood thinners and so on, and other conditions that come to light, you know, that the research is driven towards making a drug that people depend on, whether it's chemo or whatever else you can, trans, you know, mutilation surgeries, you have to do this or XYZ is going to happen. And the research is, I think, it always points in the direction of what is the most profitable, widely, you know, needed therapy of the moment to treat a condition that is probably incurable at some level. But no, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't prescribe something and put them on a patient on it for the rest of their lives and make them pay whatever can be charged for it because they have to have it. And it's this hysteria of marketing that it never used to be something in a doctor's, you know, portfolio of things that they could tell a patient. It's like, you got to do this, or the doctor often had no suggestions, or it was too late to do something, or sorry, I couldn't help you more. And that was one of the tough things always about being a doctor. But now you can, you know, tell somebody, just I'll put you on this, and you go with the health plan that covers the most of it, and every year you have to reinvent the wheel to find out how much money you can save by going here or going there, just so you can stay on this therapy. And the patent is only kind of the tail end of it. It's already been, you know, the appetite that the patient has to have is already there, and it's It's solid, and it's not going to go anywhere while that person's alive. So we're kind of in this trap of dealing with our mortality, but always trying to postpone it with whatever, you know, drug somebody is willing to give us, as long as we pay whatever they tell us to.
Well, I guess the theme of the show is, before we, the capitalists among us, before we point fingers at the new socialists among us, we kind of have to define where we are. And I'll tell you what, I look at our society, and I'll blame this on Mr. Flanagan, or I'll blame it on Larissa, because we're mature. The more mature you get, the more you seem like you get locked into the monopoly group a lot more than when you were younger. Is that a fair statement? I mean, you have to take this drug. You got to do this. You got to do that. And everywhere you turn, it's not a free market. I mean, so our idea of capitalism here, I mean, look at the bills you get every month. I mean, if you're mature, Larissa, thank you for that. If you're an old fart, you're going to get an electric bill. Okay, guess what? That's not a free market. You're going to get a gas bill. Well, that's not a free market. You're going to buy 3-4 drugs. Well, they're not free markets. Well, there's 50% of your paycheck, okay? And yet we somehow put our back to the wall and say, you know, we're capitalists, and anybody who tries to nudge it to a different direction is somehow different. I mean, Larissa, what part of your budget do you suppose is actually in any sort of a free market sort of thing? I'm going to say maybe half, maybe.
Maybe. And to some extent, you know, I was all gung-ho high on back-to-school supplies because that's been my world. Even that, I don't know how much of it is a free market, because you're looking at maybe two suppliers of these different types of supplies. There's only so many companies that make crayons. And so it might even be less than 50%.
Yeah, I mean, and yet we have people who'll fight family members over dinner and these two systems, and neither one of the systems has anything remotely what they're talking about. Is it? I mean, we could have found a way to make these things more. I mean, we have a friend, unfortunately, who's going through chemotherapy, and actually, a lot of listeners write in. Somebody, some weirdo thing where she was an ex-daughter-in-law or something, even though divorce, long story, but the thing is, this lady was paying for this lady's chemo out of the goodness of her heart, and she must have dough. I didn't ask her. She's not a client or anything. And I said, you know, at some point, you might want to think of going out of the country, because whatever the chemo she was, she looked it up. It was $45,000 here she was paying. In Italy, it was $5,000. I said, you know, it's worth the trip. And, I said, you know, get on the plane. Well, turns out the lady went downhill so fast she died before I had a chance to get... I mean, that's unconscionable that it's that much. I mean, is it really... I mean, if we got to send Mr. Flanagan at his mature age down to the Amazon to pull a wisdom tooth out of a crocodile to get the ingredient that's in this chemo... Then yeah, it ought to be $50,000. We don't want to lose Mr. Flanagan, but if it's costing them, if they're making money at $5,000, why are we paying $50,000? What is that all about? And they can give me some long story about how you know they need it for research. Well, look at their paycheck. I mean, we can first thing all of us would do is cut everybody's pay in at the top of Pfizer or Merck by about 90%. I mean, I hope this whole election process doesn't degrade into this name calling versus. And one versus the other one, it seems to me the plutocracy and the greedy hands are what's causing the problem. Is it? That's, I guess, my theme. So, Larissa, tell me I'm all nuts, and the rest of you guys can agree.
Oh, I don't know. I think we're in a system that it's really hard. And part of me is thinking, well, a couple weeks in Italy while you're being treated with basically poison your body sounds maybe a little bit nicer than sitting in whatever area she might be in this country.
Yeah.
But what a horrible decision that somebody would have to make.
Maybe, yeah, we're not talking like $5,000 versus $7,000. We're talking, right. You know, five. It was five versus seven. You could say, all right, well, the hospitals cost more money here. The hospital, you could somehow rationalize it, but 10 times as much? How do you even go down that road? And yet, most of our debate is who should pay for the 50 instead of why is it 50?
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Tom. And I think, you know, that is where, you know, where we get our big disconnect in systems. And that's, and the problem is, you're right about your assessment of that. The solutions that say, well, we'll just do Medicare for all is not going to do anything for the cost.
No, none whatsoever.
But it is a philosophy that fits an ideology, and so in that respect, you know, that's we get there.
Well, actually, split that. You might want to split that in half, Kevin, because Medicare for all, meaning everybody's covered. Are they really saying that, or are they saying? I mean, I know
when that's the exact term that is commonly used. Yes,
I know that. The question is, do they even know what they're saying? I mean, my point being is, when you get your bill, and I know you're a mature gentleman, look at the list price versus...
Not a gentleman.
Okay. Look at the list price on your bill versus what Medicare paid. Now, I might be somewhat in favor of Medicare pricing for all. That's not the same as Medicare coverage for all, is it? I guess my question is, do they even know what they're talking about? Which one are they talking about? Are they talking about Medicare being paid for by the government for all, or are they talking about Medicare pricing for all, or do they even know?
No, they're talking about, you know, that everybody would get Medicare coverage just like you and I are eligible to receive.
Okay, but if everybody got the Medicare price, maybe that would solve the problem. But I don't think the medical establishment is ready for that, are they?
I don't think the Medicare price in any way resembles a rational structure either. It's lower than than the list price you'll get and what's negotiated with a lot of insurance companies, but it's still obnoxiously
still
high.
Inflated.
Yeah, but it's less. I mean, it's
what you're doing is you're saying, okay, we're going, you know, we'll tax everybody and everybody will kick in for this program, and then we'll have price controls. And see, now as you start looking at the definition of different kinds of systems, that's where you are, is a totally, basically, even if you run it with these smatterings of independence that sort of exist in today's market, even if you do that, you are still basically running a government-controlled system.
But whatever.
My only problem with that is, well, I have several problems with that, especially when it comes to healthcare. One is that government is rarely the efficient way to do things. Sometimes it might be the only way to do things, like running an army or something like that. But the other thing is government compassionate?
To them.
No, I mean, but just in general.
No.
When have you ever referred to government as being a compassionate organization? We haven't, and that's, you know, that's, and compassion to me seems like it would be an important part of healthcare.
Well, okay, but on the totally economic side, this is where I always count on Larissa to drag us back to the economic side. We've gone through this iteration, you know, how many times, way before our lifetime. Railroads were a monopoly. Guess what? You had to put price controls there to make sure they didn't put every farmer out of business, for God's sake. Electric companies, there's one. Guess what? There's allegedly price controls. Whether or not, you know, they pay all the people off to where it's worse than in the first place, that's another issue, but there are price controls. The gas company, there's price controls. Well, you just mentioned, you know, price controls in medicine. What if we get down to two hospital groups in Chicago? And this question is directed as Larissa. Should we expect price controls at some point there because we're not dealing with anything competitive? Whenever something's not competitive, I don't know who's the more philanthropic, the government or a monopolist? I mean, Larissa, give us the economic argument. At some point, when it becomes totally one person, you almost, I won't say have to have price control, but we always have reacted to price controls. I mean, if we get down to two or three airlines, which is where we're going, do you think we're not going to have price controls on airfare again? I mean, sure we will. I don't want to, but listen, please comment.
Well, and if we get to that type of environment with price controls where we only have one or two competitors, we're starting to inch towards what you would consider the socialist society, which is what we were starting to discuss earlier today.
Well, that's my point. It's kind of a circle here, isn't it?
It is. And given the younger generations, that might be a direction that they are actually interested.
Well, I think...
Yeah, and whereas my interest would be maybe we should enforce antitrust laws and we wouldn't have to worry about industry consolidation to the same degree.
Kevin, you and I, when have we ever agreed to that extent ever?
Probably, it happens every 5 or 6 months.
When you're young, the radical solution always is preferable because you are hell-bent on making a change that you can enjoy for the rest of your life, and you have all sorts of visions of what the world can be and should be, how you fit into it. So it's attractive to people when they're younger to do things that by the time they reach my age, they'd be horrified by.
Well, we do have some competition from trucking and some stuff, but I don't know if you guys, I sunk my teeth into the railroad stuff. Way on the back burner with all the other stuff we talk about. A merger is in the offing between, for those that don't know, other than the Canadian National owning the old Illinois Central and a couple others, little ones, you got four railroads, two west and two east. You got the Burlington going west, and you got the Union Pacific. All right, the Union Pacific owns the Southern Pacific, and the Burlington owns everything north and Santa Fe. So, and now we have two west. You've got the Norfolk and Southern, and you got the Chessie system. Well, the Union Pacific wants to merge with the Norfolk and Southern. Now, if you do that, of course, you got to let the other two idiots merge, right? So now you're down to two coast-to-coast railroads. Are we going to just let them charge everybody goddamn please? Or when I say we, or is somebody going to say, we got to take a look at this, and we got to make sure that somebody doesn't, where there's a road between two places that they charge way less than when there isn't a road between two places. Do we have to go back to that? I mean, this is insane. Yet, I mean, and then you're going to have two people running for office, where one is supposedly a capitalist when he's defending what isn't even capitalism, and the other person's espousing socialism when he's not even talking about socialism, and yet we're voting on that. I guess that's my bitch today, so what can I say? Larissa, give me an F paper, please. I probably deserve one.
No, it's an interesting problem, and again, it's the bigger overarching themes of economic and social pressures.
Yeah, and before you can define these things, you sort of have to define yourself. And I can't even define our system now. It's a combination of God knows what. There's a little bit of everything in here, isn't there? A little bit of socialism, a little bit of fascism, a little bit of capitalism someplace. I guess if you're in a
oligarchism.
Yeah, a little bit of that, a little plutocracy. We got all kinds of stuff going on, a little oligarchy. Depends on which side you're on, right? Just to give you a whole thing, and this is I should never have kind of done this for a client. Larissa, you'll love this. We have, I think he's still a client of some sort, but he... I'll say it. It's a group that's mostly all Jewish, right? And those guys, a lot of them are doctors, and a lot of them are involved in, they know that industry, like I know my industry. So this is not disparaging at all. And they get themselves involved in a lot of these startup drug and companies that, have medical equipment and so forth. And most of them are like really good ideas. It seems like it, because I've read some of them. I never told anybody to buy anything. I never bought any myself, but they would send me stuff and I'd read it. And some of them are pretty damn good ideas. And in every single case, I mean, these guys are looking for the next company that becomes the Pfizer or whatever. And in every single case, because I watch this stuff, well, I didn't watch all of them, but I watch a lot of them. And if the companies that actually had something going, at some point they got bought out by a bigger firm. So say you invest in, it's like the lottery almost, you invest in 10 of these companies, and you think two of them might do okay and one of them might be the home run, right? And I went out to this guy's house and I explained it to him. I said, you guys got to stop doing this, because look at what's happening. Every time you get the home run, which should return enough money to pay for all the other crap you bought, some drug company swoops in when they're out of dough and says, we'll get you through the process. By the way, we'll buy it at $6 instead of $1, which sounds like a home run, but the real value is like $40. I said, you're never going to get your home run. So you got to be careful. If you buy 10 of them and one of them becomes the home run, that's a rational decision. But if the system is so against you that you never can hit the home run because nobody else can get it through the quote system, and somebody always has to come in and a discount help you out, that is not healthy. This is 15 years ago. It's not changed. That's wrong. That's not capitalism. It's not. I don't know what it is, but it's. So it's not anything we think of as the system, is it? You can never win.
No. One final thought from me anyway, and that is, when we talk about competition and healthcare being such a good example of the lack thereof, there is one area where the price has come down over the years dramatically, and that's LASIK surgery.
Yeah, well, that's independent people still do that.
Because that hasn't been covered by insurance, so it had to compete.
Well, you also, everybody who does LASIK that I know of, those are still independent practices.
Everything about that market, they're independent because they're not insured. If insurance isn't going to pay for it, then insurance isn't going to have the undue influence. Insurance companies are not going to buy up the practice, everything that we've identified as part of the cause is gone when it comes to that particular healthcare service.
Right, the system has to make it affordable, not the insurance companies.
Larissa, final thought. What do you make of this? Just a big mess or what?
I do. I'll make it of it as a big old mess. And I think that I'll be curious what young people look to do to shape the economic and social pressures of the future.
You know what I'd love for you to do, and you got way too much stuff on your plate already on your classes. Put the words up there. Socialism, capitalism, fascism. Put a couple more up there, communism. See if anybody even can really define them. I bet they can't. I'm not too sure I can after reading them all, up on all of them. What do you think you'd get out of your class, other than an argument?
Again, most of my students, they immediately think of communism, and once we even start discussing it, they see that it's something good.
Really?
They like this idea. And I think this goes back to John's point about young people wanting to change the system, and they're going to go radically in a different direction so that they can really feel the change.
Well, I went for a wedding of all things. I went to Denmark, and it's supposedly this big socialist system. But everybody owned their own stuff. I mean, the guy that we didn't stay at their house, but it was his daughter who got married. He owned his own auto repair shop. I mean, his taxes were higher, and the college was included, and medical care was included. But they didn't own his auto parts shop. You don't think the people now that you say like communism or socialism want the government to come take their dad's bar, do they? I mean, because that's kind of the difference between the two. Do they even equate that with socialism?
Well, we hear all the time about Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, and they are no more socialist. You know, Bernie Sanders likes to cite them, and Bernie Sanders would be appalled by their economy because it is everything he rails against is built into theirs. They aren't, they aren't all that socialist.
No, that's my point. They're not. I mean, that's why I brought up the word kibbutz, where you actually didn't own anything. Nobody wants that, do they?
Right. When the Netherlands was trying to force its farmers, to give up their, cattle raising and everything else, their dairy production that their livelihood is dependent on, in the name of climate, considerations, the population rebelled pretty violently. So I mean, they've got the the capital spirit, as I think people at some level everywhere have, and you know, some governments have learned to kind of harness it or control it, but others have just want to, you know, trash it. So,
but when you get to the point where you can't become, you can't get in. I mean, I don't think anybody can. It'd be really hard to open up a brokerage firm today. There's no way you can, a regular person, can get out and trade on the trading floor and make markets. And when you slice off the barriers to entry to that extent, then I think you got a problem. You know, and I think kind of we're there. I mean, fortunately, I think people can still become college professors. You know, that's probably still somewhat competitive. I don't know. You know, but I mean, and I would challenge, maybe next week we'll see. Last time we did this was about how many years ago, Kevin? We challenged everybody on the show to name 10 competitive industries. I think everybody on the show is pretty, we have trouble with that. Farming, maybe, bars, maybe, barbershops, beauty shops. I mean, you could, then all of a sudden, you don't really need your toes to help you count, do you? I mean, you sort of don't. So anyway, guys, S&P futures up 42, NASDAQ futures up 77. Thank you, Andrew. We'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. And thank you, guys. It was one of the best discussions I think we've had. I hope you feel the same way. God, we're
thanks,
so.
Thanks,
well, why are we all agreeing all of a sudden? Maybe it's Larissa's influence. Did she cook us breakfast or something, for God's sake?
It's a good influence.
It's a good influence. Anyway, thank you, Larissa. Back tomorrow,
thanks,
Stocks and Jacks.
Have a great week.
All right.
Yeah.
That's all, folks.